or a fourth. She shifted restlessly, adjusting the ice on her shoulder. Strangest aspect of the scene? The front door, as well as all the windows, were unlocked. I mean, I get the front door. Guy thoughtfully prepared himself a master key ahead of time, then used it to access Flora's apartment. But why unlock all the windows? Why even take the time for such a subtle piece of theatrics? To prove he could? To emphasize no one is safe? Arrogant, Dee Dee muttered. Alex shrugged, topped off his wine. Not the first time. But sounds like your missing girl, Flora, has some skills as well. She might have been abducted, but she's hardly a helpless victim.
True.
I think I'm going to make a call in the morning. Talk to an FBI agent out of Atlanta, Kimberly Quincy. Name sounds familiar. I spoke with her once before, a couple of years ago, for the Charlene Grant case. Quincy was apparently the agent who finally located Jacob Ness. She led the raid to rescue Flora. Alex gave her a look. And you want to talk to Quincy, why?
I don't know, Dee Dee said honestly. But somehow, whatever happened 5 years ago, Flora's never gotten over it.
How could she?
Sure, but most victims of these long-term kidnappings, they retreat. They work on their recovery, focus on appreciating everyday life, write a book, sell movie rights, whatever. According to Flora's mother, however, Flora never talks about her time with Jacob Ness. And yet, the self-defense classes, the bedroom wall lined with missing persons cases, her obsession with Stacy Summers. Flora's absolutely, positively still driven by what happened to her. My guess? If I'm going to anticipate what she did leading up to Saturday afternoon and what she's capable of doing next, I need to learn about her own experience. She survived the unthinkable once before, so what compels her back to that same set of circumstances? Is there some wound she's trying to heal? Or a lesson she still hasn't learned?
Survivor's guilt.
Maybe.
Dee Dee adjusted the ice pack on her shoulder. I'll tell you what she should feel guilty about, though. Her mom. Her poor mother. Having to go through this all over again.
Dee Dee didn't sleep well. Not unusual when working a major case. Her mind swirled with investigative details, leading to dreams of faceless girls running down endless black corridors. Then Dee Dee was racing breathlessly through a shadowed house, basement, house again, heart thundering against her chest. She rounded a corner and there she was, Flora Dane. Or Stacy Summers? No, definitely Flora Dane, holding a gun leveled at Dee Dee's head.
Bang, dream Flora said. You're dead.
Dee Dee woke up. Dee Dee got out of bed. She crept into her son's room, soothed herself with the sight of him sleeping peacefully. Then she headed to the kitchen and got serious about her day. FBI agents had a tendency to work civilian hours. Sure, they bragged about their go-bags, ready to fly out the door at a moment's notice, but compared to the demands of urban policing, say, a Boston detective's job, Fed hours were pretty sedate. Dee Dee decided to play an educated guess. If memory served, SAC Kimberly Quincy had two daughters, meaning, like most parents, she was up early. Combine that with the horrendous traffic in Atlanta, what with that spaghetti junction, whatever, any commuter had an incentive to head to the office sooner versus later, meaning Dee Dee's best bet for contacting the federal agent would be first thing in the morning. 5:30 a.m. seemed a tad early, so Dee Dee worked on her shoulder and arm PT. She showered, changed, then heard Jack calling. Scooping him out of his race car bed with her good arm, she remembered the mandatory vroom vroom noises. Then they were zigzagging down the hall, careening downstairs before a pedal-to-the-metal sprint for dinosaur-shaped pancakes in the kitchen. The dino shapes were courtesy of molds purchased by Alex, an impulse buy that had caused Dee Dee to roll her eyes, but God knows Jack adored them. Pancakes were definitely twice as good when shaped as a brontosaurus. Jack took breakfast in his footy pajamas, as pancakes were a messy, maple-y affair guaranteed to wreck any hope of clean clothes, let alone the amount of syrup he managed to get in his fine hair. The pajamas would go in the wash. As for the maple syrup, Dee Dee thought he could carry the spiky-haired look.
Syrup, hair gel, in the world of toddlers, what did it matter? Having missed so much time with her son, she did the honors of dressing him for preschool. Then she produced Candyland, and with a stack of color-coded cards, not to mention Jolly the Gumdrop to keep Jack entertained in the family room, Dee Dee retreated to the kitchen to dial Atlanta. She got lucky on her first try. "Quincy," the FBI agent answered. "Morning. Sergeant Detective Dee Dee Warren from Boston PD. We spoke once before, a couple of years ago. Charlene Grant, you handled her friend's murder in Atlanta." "Oh, yeah. Hey, good job on that one. Honestly, didn't think Charlie would survive the 21st. Well, every now and then this job is actually gratifying. So I'm working on a new case, and your name has come up." Dee Dee filled in the agent on Flora Dane's recent activities leading up to her disappearance. "I understand you're the agent who finally located Jacob Ness." "True." The agent's voice had grown quieter, somber. Some cases left a mark. Dee Dee already suspected Flora's case, the raid to rescue her, was one of them. "What do you know of Flora's kidnapping 7 years ago?" "Not much. Boston wasn't involved, as she disappeared down in Florida." "Yes. Pretty typical setup. College girl on spring break out drinking with friends. She needed to use the restrooms. They let her go alone, and just like that, she was gone." "I'm working something similar right now," Dee Dee said, wondering already if that's why Flora had responded so strongly to Stacy Summers's abduction. "Unfortunately, the case was a slow starter. Drunk friends don't make the best reporters. Not to mention they got it in their heads that Flora had headed home. And I don't mean their hotel room. I mean sometime in the middle of the rum-soaked club scene, she'd decided to return up north. So they didn't exactly comb the beaches looking for her." "Oh, geez." "Eventually, one of the girls thought to call Flora's mom up in Maine. Now, the mom's a smart, tough woman. Ruth? Rachel? Rosa. Rosa, that's it. She filed the missing persons report and got the ball rolling, but at that point the trail was already 48, 56 hours old. Local PD did a little digging, came up with nothing." Dee Dee nodded her head, not surprised. Missing persons was always a race against the clock. In this case, Flora had never stood a chance. "How'd the FBI get involved?" Dee Dee asked. "Postcard. I can't remember all the particulars, but a matter of weeks, maybe a month later, Rosa received a postcard from her daughter. It was postmarked Jacksonville. Looked like her daughter's handwriting, but the content raised some red flags."
"How so?"
"I can email you a copy, but the tone was almost manic. Having the best time, Mom. Met the cutest guy. You should see where I'm staying. Perfect room. Couldn't be happier. And the sex is fantastic. Give Chili my love."
"What?"
Dee Dee asked, genuinely startled. "Yeah, not exactly the kind of note most girls send home to their moms. Rosa Dane got a little upset, to say the least. Now, the reference to Chili? That was Flora's first dog, long deceased. The BAU profiler who assisted with the case believed Jacob made her include that detail to authenticate the note. It couldn't have been sent by a random stranger who read about her disappearance in the paper. The unsub wanted Rosa, all of us, to know this was the real deal. I'm sure you also analyzed the handwriting?"
"Yes, but that analysis was actually less than a slam dunk. Certain letters were deemed a match, but the letters were smaller, crunched and shaky, which muddled the findings."
Dee Dee had to think about it. Because Flora was writing it under duress? Or because she herself had changed, terrified, abused, starving? All possibilities considered at the time. The most important takeaway was the overall message. Flora was having the best time ever, with some cute guy having fantastic sex. No, "Hey, Mom, sorry I took off while on spring break, but you don't need to worry, I'm with some friends." In other words, the unsub wasn't interested in covering up Flora's disappearance. He solely wanted to taunt the mom with the obvious message that Flora had been kidnapped. "Is this the part where the profiler claims the evil unsub was potty-trained at gunpoint?" "Oh, our profiler had even more opinions than that. But we were still assembling information back then. We had a first message and a postmark. The Jacksonville police traced the postcard to a single post office located off a busy interstate. No video cameras on the outside boxes, however, so that became a dead end. But there was more. Yes. 3 months later, a second card arrived. The first had been of a beach sunset. This one was a Georgia peach and postmarked Atlanta. "Ah, now you join the hunt," Dee Dee filled in. "And now I join the hunt," Kimberly agreed. Contents of this postcard were similar. Amazing time, best guy ever, the sex is even more incredible. And good news, I finally lost those last 10 pounds. She'd lost weight? Dee Dee had to think about it. Did Flora Dane need to lose 10 pounds? No. She was an active, outdoorsy girl. According to her mom, she didn't have 10 pounds to spare. Oh, my God. For the first time, Dee Dee got the pattern behind the messages. It left her feeling queasy. He was starving her. That's the taunt, everything he says. The cute guy, that's her ugly-ass kidnapper. The amazing sex, that's the endless nights of sexual assault. And losing 10 pounds? What a... Dee Dee didn't have a strong enough word for Jacob Ness. It was a good thing he was already dead, or she would have felt a need to track him down and kill him all over again. At this stage, Flora had been missing approximately 4 months. With evidence that she's still alive and has crossed state lines, now it's full-on federal mobilization. Except, we couldn't gain any traction. There was no video, no witnesses to her abduction. Did she walk out with a guy? Was she ambushed? We couldn't find anyone who saw anything. "I have video of an abduction," Dee Dee offered, "and we still can't find anyone who knows anything. What about the postcards?" "We traced the second note to the originating post office, but again, no video, no witnesses. All we got was that both post offices were near major interstates. Easy on and off for someone who's traveling." "Does the second postcard include anything personal?" "Please feed the foxes." Apparently, when Flora was growing up, she liked to tame the wild foxes on her mother's farm. "Rose's necklace," Dee Dee said. "It has a fox charm." "Exactly." Handwriting on the second postcard shows further deterioration. It's spidery, shaky, lacks strength. If you're into graphology, predicting personality based on, say, the slant of your handwriting, Flora's breaking down. "I'm familiar with graphology," Dee Dee supplied. "Not sure what I think, but in a case where you don't have much else to go on..." "You take whatever you can get," Kimberly agreed. "Given our lack of leads and the unsub's clear interest in Flora's mom, the profiler advised a press conference with Rosa, front and center. The unsub was communicating with her. Now it would be her turn to communicate directly with him, and frankly, see if we could elicit some kind of response." "Did it work?" "Not that we could figure out at the time. The profiler drafted a media message designed to humanize Flora, focus on her loving family, unique upbringing in the wilds of Maine, her kindness to others, etc. Rosa was dressed up to appear as all-American mom as possible. Basically, the kidnapper was crafting one storyline, an overly sexualized college girl obsessed with guys. We went to the other extreme. A nature-loving, good girl, adored by everyone who knew her." Dee Dee couldn't help but arch a brow. That didn't quite jibe with the dark, edgy Flora she knew, which made her wonder. Maybe Flora's mom had been right after all. Dee Dee had never met and would never know the real Flora Dane. She had only encountered Jacob Ness's twisted creation, 472 days in the making. "Rosa did her part," Kimberly was saying now. "She stood up there, looked right in the cameras, and delivered a message that was empathetic, genuine, and moving. The news teams ate her up. We got full national coverage for a solid week, boosted by her appearances on several major morning shows, which is not something easy or automatic for a woman who, up until then, had been happiest driving a tractor." Dee Dee understood. What the media expected of victims in this day and age wasn't for the faint of heart, let alone when the lead investigator was standing at a grieving parent's shoulder saying, "This must be done. You want your kid back? Then this is what it takes. Exposing your heart and soul on the national stage." "What happened next?" Dee Dee asked. "Nothing."
"Nothing?"
"Nothing. Week after week, month after month. Trail went cold. Rosa talked and talked and talked, received no postcards or messages in reply. We blasted Flora's picture all across the world. We got no credible leads, which, at a certain point, starts to tell you something, such as Flora's either locked away so tightly there are no witnesses, or he's done a bang-up job altering her appearance. And he either doesn't care about the press conferences, or he didn't see them. Didn't see them. Our profiler, Ken McCarthy, didn't believe it would be possible for the unsub who'd started the conversation to simply walk away. So if our attempts at communication weren't eliciting a response, maybe he wasn't getting the messages. Which brought us to the next phase of our investigation, where we chased down every southern recluse and off-the-grid survivalist with a history of sexual assaults. Now that was a list. Not a bad strategy, Dee Dee granted. Certainly someone like that would fit your profile. Taunting the mother is a proxy for an authority figure, right? Hey, we're the FBI. We can make anything look good on paper. Unfortunately, we were wrong. So what happened? Jacob. Eventually, he reached out again, except this time it wasn't a postcard. It was an email sent from a dummy account to Rosa's personal email. It contained an audio of Flora talking. Dee Dee winced. She couldn't imagine what that must have been like for Rosa, to, after all this time, hear her daughter's voice, and yet the things, the terrible, twisted words that must have come from her daughter's mouth. Escalation of communication is not atypical, Kimberly said quietly. We assured Rosa this was a good thing. It meant Flora was still alive. It meant, as strange as it sounded, that he still cared. Now, him moving to email helped us. We could trace the IP address back to an internet cafe, this time in Alabama, and, like the post offices, located near a major interstate. This led us to our next investigative leap, from looking at survivalists hunkered down in backwoods to looking at someone who was mobile, say, salespeople, truck drivers. Given the long hours on the road, these people might not catch the morning news shows or the 5 o'clock wrap-up, hence the unsub's lack of reaction to our TV blitz. We adjusted our communication strategy accordingly, targeting mediums that would be more accessible to someone with a transient lifestyle. We emphasized social media, such as daily Facebook posts, that the unsub might access during his downtime on a laptop or mobile device. We also targeted local radio stations and independent newspapers, the kind of daily pubs that are easily accessible at diners, gas stations, motels. Flora's brother created a whole Facebook page for this phase, plastered with personal photos of Flora as well as snapshots from her daily life, the farm, the woods around it, a fox playing in the backyard. He also sat with his mom and generated lists of Facebook posts, one for each day, covering everything from Flora's favorite book to local events, family anniversaries she was now missing. We invited friends and neighbors to contribute as well, anything to remind the unsub over and over again of who Flora truly was, a young woman deeply missed by family and friends. He issued communications to break her down. You built her back up. We needed him to make contact. If countering his message drove him to send more and more postcards, emails, videos, all the better for us. He sent videos? Provoking him into further outreach remained our best strategy for catching him. Did you design this strategy? Dee Dee asked. Yes. According to Rosa, Jacob's stupidity is what got him caught. He sent one too many messages and you nailed him. But talking to you, that was the plan. You weren't waiting for him to randomly email. You were baiting him into further communications. This kind of strategy, it's hard in the family. Kimberly sighed. The investigative team might have been the general, sitting in a back room, strategizing away, but Rosa, Darwin, they were our foot soldiers. They had to sit down every day and beg for Flora's life. They had to suffer through degrading postcards, audio recordings, and then that video. We advised both of them not to watch, but, of course, they were so desperate for some sign, some connection to their loved one. The brother vomited, twice, and Rosa, she went blank. We ended up calling for medical. I thought she'd broken, and we'd never get her back. I understand the family has a different perspective on things. Of course they do. At the end of the day, they were the best tool we had to get Flora back. We used them shamelessly. And it worked.
So how did you find him?
As we hoped, Jacob started communicating more, especially via email, which allowed us to start tracking his progress across the southern states. By 14 months in, we were sure he had to be a truck driver, delivery man, something of that nature. The bulk of the emails were from internet cafes, some truck stops, all located near major interstates. So we shored up state police patrols of those areas, faxed Flora's photo to all the major truck stops. We wanted to apply pressure, but not too much. You didn't want him to panic, dispose of her.
Exactly.
But mostly we focused on the internet cafes. 471 days later, he sent an email we could trace back to a cyber cafe at a truck stop he'd used once before. I personally drove out to the truck stop to interview the staff. All those postcards, emails, outreaches later, Jacob had revealed more of himself than he realized. Sure enough, the moment I started to describe the kind of man we were looking for, the manager ID'd him. Jacob was a regular, stopped by at least once a month, if not more, on his route. The manager didn't know Jacob's last name, but he could describe his rig. We connected the remaining dots from there. Jacob Ness, a registered sex offender who had already served time for molesting a 14-year-old girl, suspected of several more sex assaults, currently working as an independent contractor for several major delivery firms, driving a big rig. In a matter of hours, a state trooper discovered Jacob's transport parked outside a motel just off the interstate. I mobilized SWAT, and we got serious. Dee Dee didn't need the FBI agent to say anything more. She could already picture it perfectly in her head, the adrenaline rush of such moments, at the cusp of breaking a major case. Do everything right, you get to save the girl, catch the bad guy, but one wrong move... Girl winds up killed, bad guy escapes, and a life, a family, your career is over. Yeah, she could picture it.
What'd you do? She asked.
We confirmed with hotel management which room Jacob was in, and that he'd entered with a female companion. The room was an end unit with no rear door. That was the good news. Now for the bad news. We had reason to believe Jacob was in possession of at least one firearm, if not more. Also, our profiler, McCarthy, believed that if cornered, Jacob would be most likely to shoot Flora, then himself, rather than surrender.
Suicide by cop?
Possible, but only after killing Flora. McCarthy felt at this stage of their relationship, Jacob felt a strong attachment to Flora. The nature of his taunts, his need to torment the family, she was his. And he wouldn't give her up without a fight.
Relationship.
Dee Dee had to think about this. She was familiar with Stockholm Syndrome, though more from movie plots than real-life experience. That syndrome, made famous by the Patty Hearst case, described how a victim bonded with her attacker over time, feeling empathy, even loyalty, for the very person who had caused her harm. But Dee Dee had never considered such a process in reverse— that by virtue of time and total dominance, a kidnapper might develop a certain affection for his captive. Jacob Ness had been a long-haul trucker, meaning for years he'd been traveling alone, living in isolation, until the day he'd snatched Flora Dane and brought her along with him. 472 days of companionship later, Dee Dee could see why he'd be loath to give her up.
"Did you worry about Stockholm Syndrome?" she asked Kimberly now. "That Flora might not welcome your rescue efforts?"
On the other end of the phone, Dee Dee could hear the agent's hesitation.
"We were prepared for anything," Kimberly said at last, which Dee Dee took to be a yes.
"So you have an armed subject holed up in a hotel room with a victim who's suffered severe long-term trauma. What did you do?"
"Let SWAT lead the charge," Kimberly said bluntly. "They fired in half a dozen canisters of tear gas through the room's front window. Then they took down the door."
The federal agent paused. "They found Jacob sprawled on the ground, clearly incapacitated by the gas. Next to him was a damp hand towel. Apparently he'd noticed the officers mobilizing outside, had made some effort to prepare for their charge. But he hadn't been fast enough."
"And Flora?"
"She sat on the floor beside him. She had a wet towel tied around her mouth and nose. She also had a gun."
Dee Dee's eyes widened.
Of all the things. She had Jacob's gun.
Yeah.
Did she point it at the SWAT team?
No.
She had the gun on her lap. She was stroking Jacob's face. She was wiping the tears from his eyes.
Oh.
Dee Dee didn't know why, but somehow that image was worse.
Jacob was conscious when I entered the room, whispering to Flora. The gas was already starting to dissipate. We needed to move quickly, but no one wanted to rush Flora as long as she had the gun. We were afraid if we spooked her, she might open fire. It was a strange sight. He was begging her. Jacob Ness was sprawled on the floor, begging Flora to kill him.
Dee Dee didn't have words for that.
I tried to get her attention. I called her name, tried to get her to look at me, but she wouldn't respond. Not to me, not to any of the officers. Her attention was solely for Jacob, stroking his hair, rubbing the tears from his cheeks. She seemed not just attentive to him, but tender.
Dee Dee knew tear gas. It didn't just inflame the eyes. It turned the subject's nose, everything, to a giant, streaming, mucousy mess. Jacob Ness would have been in a great deal of discomfort, desperate for water to flush his eyes, tissue to blow his nose. But he hadn't surrendered. Instead, the man who'd been taunting his victim's family and investigators for more than a year had pulled himself together for one last move.
What did he do?
He kept talking to Flora. Talking, talking, talking. And then, just when we thought we'd have to make our move one way or another, Flora suddenly leaned over and whispered something in his ear.
What?
I don't know. Flora's never said. But she told him something. And the expression on his face? Jacob Ness looked scared out of his mind. Then Flora grabbed the gun off her lap and pulled the trigger. 45 Magnum to the top of the skull. It got the job done. Flora dropped the gun, SWAT took her down, and that was that.
Dee Dee couldn't speak.
You know about trauma bonding, right? The agent asked abruptly. Forget kidnapping victims. You see it all the time with battered women. They're isolated, at the mercy of their dominating spouse, going through intense spells of abject terror, followed by even more emotionally draining periods of soul-wrenching apologies. The trauma itself creates a powerful bonding element. The things these two have gone through together, how could anyone else ever understand? It becomes one more thing that makes a woman stay, even after her husband has beat the crap out of her again.
I know trauma bonding.
I expected to see it with Flora Dane. How could you not? 472 days later, I couldn't even get her to respond to her own name. Instead, she identified herself as Molly, the name Jacob had given her.
Okay.
Trauma bonding is most likely to occur in situations where the victim is isolated and the perpetrator appears all-powerful. We found in the rear of Jacob's cab a wooden coffin bearing a padlock. It bore traces of Flora's hair as well as DNA.
Dee Dee closed her eyes.
That's isolating, she agreed. Jacob put her in the box, but Jacob was also the one who took her out. Jacob starved her for long periods of time, but he was also the one who gave her food.
Which would make him all-powerful.
So here's the issue. Flora absolutely, positively shows signs of trauma bonding, which, we know from other cases, makes victims stay even when they could run. Flora had opportunities to escape, but didn't take them. We learned that by the end, Flora accompanied Jacob everywhere of her own free will. He could leave her sitting alone in restaurants or waiting for him in hotel rooms. She stayed, which to outsiders makes her appear complacent, a willing victim. Anyone who has experienced trauma bonding, however, will tell you that in those moments, she was just as physically restrained as if he'd wrapped her in chains. Such is the power of the bond.
Okay.
Dee Dee was familiar with trauma bonding, though it was hard for her to associate the Flora she had met 48 hours ago, the woman who'd burned Devin Goulding alive, with that level of submission. Trauma bonding can also lead to someone committing acts they wouldn't normally have done otherwise. Patty Hearst, wielding the M1 carbine.
Exactly.
There are many well-documented cases of victims that, over time and torture, have become accomplices to their own attackers. In this case, we found more than Flora's DNA in that pine box. In fact, we found DNA from several different unidentified girls.
Oh.
Didi didn't know what else to say. The FBI agent was right. Especially in cases where the victim was held for a long period of time, many reached a point where they assisted in ambushing others. It was tempting to lay blame, though psychologists would frown upon such things. Kimberly had been right. The trauma bond coerced the victim into compliance as powerfully as physical force.
You think Jacob Ness might have grabbed additional girls?
I think I would have liked to ask him that question. In fact, the more we dug into his life, the more suspicions we had. Unfortunately, we'll never know exactly what he did, how many women he might have raped and even murdered.
What does Flora say?
She doesn't. She's never talked about what happened to her. In the beginning, we gave her time and space based, frankly, on the advice of Dr. Keynes, but later? We know that box held girls other than Flora. We can't, however, say when the evidence got there. For example, maybe the DNA from other victims occurred before he kidnapped Flora, versus during the same time period. Given that, we don't have grounds to subpoena her. If she doesn't want to talk, she doesn't have to.
You think she's covering for herself? For what she might have done, under duress or not?
I think there are questions I'd like to ask that Flora's gone out of her way not to answer. Not to mention... Kimberly paused again. Between agent and investigator? Because in this day and age, when we're never supposed to blame the victim, by all means. As I was leading Flora out of the hotel room, she paused for one moment, looked back at Jacob's body. She'd lost the towel by then. I could see her face. And just for a second, her eyes sparked. It was like watching a machine come to life. She appeared triumphant.
Having just shot her own kidnapper? Dee Dee guessed.
Or maybe having just killed the only other person who knew exactly what she'd been up to over the past year. I can tell you one thing. Dozens, if not hundreds, of law enforcement officers were involved in the search for Flora Dane. And yet, for all of us, 472 days of that woman's life remain a complete mystery. Chapter 29. I'm not okay. I want to be. I want to be strong, in control, resolved. Not hungry, not thirsty, not hot, not cold, not in pain, not terrified. I am the new and improved Flora Dane, the kind of woman who will never be a victim again. I'm shaking uncontrollably. The name. Why does this girl call herself Molly? She's not Molly. I know she's not Molly because I knew a Molly once. I was a Molly once. That can't be a coincidence, right? And the pine coffins? The endless procession of cheap pine coffins? What the hell is going on here? He's dead. Jacob's dead. I have to tell myself this. I'm huddled in a corner, bound arms looped tight around my knees. Jacob's dead, and I know Jacob's dead because I pulled the trigger. I felt his blood, bits of his skull, blow back into my face. I left that room, finally free after 472 days, with Jacob's brain matter stuck in my hair. He's dead. He's dead. He's dead. I have tears streaming down my cheeks. I hate myself for the weakness. And I hate even more that small, miserable, pathetic part of me that still misses him. I am not okay. The girl is on the mattress, I think. She crawled there on her own. She's sleeping now, or has fallen unconscious, or is dying. Probably I should check on her. But she said her name is Molly, and now I can't stand her. That FBI agent, staring straight at me, Flora, Flora, Flora. Myself, no idea who she's talking about. My name is Molly. Victims and captors form a bond. You don't have to like it. You don't have to understand it. That's just the way it is. Dr. Keynes explained this to me many times. I couldn't help forming a relationship with Jacob any more than I couldn't help being hungry, thirsty, and tired. Human beings are social creatures. We aren't meant to live in a vacuum, or more specifically, locked away in a coffin-sized box. Jacob might have been evil, but he was also very smart. He knew what he was doing every time he stuck me in that box and denied me light, food, water, companionship, and he knew exactly what he was doing each time he took me back out. Becoming my hero. Becoming the all-powerful father figure I never had. Of course I listened and obeyed. You don't piss off the all-powerful father figure, and you don't leave him either. not even when you might suddenly, unexpectedly have the chance. Because he is all-powerful. And if he says he knows where your mother lives, and your brother, and your den of favorite foxes, and he can track them down and kill them any time he wants, you believe him. When he says you're his favorite, and he never meant to keep you alive this long, but somehow you've grown on him, you're special. Worthy. Maybe even the one woman who could finally make him happy. You believe that, too. And this girl, huddled away across the room from me in the dark, has she also been shut up in a box? Has she also endured hours, if not days, on end of her own pathetic company, until she too would have sold her very soul just to get out? I can't trust her. That's the problem with girls who were once trapped in coffin-sized boxes. Just ask Jacob. You can't trust any of us. I scrub at my face with my bound hands. I can't keep doing this, I think, rocking back and forth. I was stupid for trying to find Stacy Summers, for arrogantly thinking I could take on the big bads of the world. I was misguided. I don't know. Everything my mom and Samuel accused me of. And now I see the light. I repent. I just want out of this godforsaken pitch-black room. I just want to return to my apartment and resume normal life again. Except, of course, I've never figured out how to do normal, how to settle for everyday routine. I'm not okay. I'm not okay. I'm not okay. I'm not okay.
Why?
The girl speaks. The sound of her voice, so unexpected in the dark, shocks me into paying attention. I wait. Ears attuned.
Why?
She whispers again.
Why?
I wonder if what she means to ask is, why me? I unloop my arms from my knees, one last scrub of my cheeks, one last sniff. I pull myself together. I have a headache. That's real enough. My head feels fuzzy and my body lethargic. I wonder once again about drugs. Misted into the air? Injected into the water bottle? I can't smell or taste anything, but I definitely don't feel like myself. Of course, trauma can do that to you. But I'm functional. I can sit. I can stand. I can move. Time to do something. We need to get out of here, I say out loud. I sound hoarse, raw, and determined, almost like a woman who knows what she's doing. The girl doesn't reply. I rise to my feet, shuffle forward to the wall where I know the door is. This time, feeling around with my fingertips, I can easily determine its edges. The door opens out. That's my memory. The door opening out, the silhouetted form stepping in, then myself lunging forward with my wooden dagger. I push against it now and feel it give slightly. I stop, stunned by this development. Surely my mind is playing tricks on me, and yet another experimental push. The door jiggles. It's closed, I realize, but maybe not locked tight. Ordinarily, you'd simply turn the handle, retracting the latch from the hole in the strike plate, and voila, open sesame, except in this case. I blink my eyes several times, contemplating options. On this side of the door, there's no knob to turn. But if I could find a way to suppress the latch, say, shimmy in a sliver of wood, I might get lucky. Of course, I need a piece of wood. I think there might be one more tucked in the mattress. I can't remember. My thoughts are muddled. Stress, fatigue, the presence of a girl named Molly. No choice. I have to do this. I retreat from the secret door, crawling toward the mattress. I don't know what to say. Everything will be okay? So sorry to have stabbed you? Who the hell are you, anyway? What I manage is... Hey... She whimpers. I don't want to know her name, I decide. I'm not having that conversation. Instead, it's time to get practical. Do you know where we are? Fresh whimper. Is this room part of a house? Are we on the first floor, second floor? More whimpering. I can't take it anymore. I sit back on my heels, inches from the mattress, and make my voice as hard as possible. Hey! We need to get out of here. You need medical attention. Now start talking. Where the hell are we? She doesn't whimper this time, more like a shaky inhale. Then, just when I'm wondering if I'm going to have to slap her or something, she whispers,
Why are you making me do this?
I keep my voice firm. Which floor are we on? Which level of the building?
I don't know. Why?
Were you kept in a room? I interrupt. Something like this one? Or maybe exactly this one, as the previous occupant? I can hear a shuddering exhale. How long have you been here? I don't mean to ask that question. It's not relevant, but I can't help myself. She doesn't answer, and a second later I realize she probably can't. Certainly I'm already confused on timeline, disoriented by the lack of light. What's the last thing you remember? I ask instead.
Dancing.
You were at a bar? A nightclub? In Boston? It takes her a bit, but finally...
Yes.
Did you drink too much? A small hiccup I take to be yes. Kids, I think, were all so young and fearless once. Nightclubs are nothing but a source of adventure, and a fourth, fifth, sixth rum runner is the best idea in the world. I hated myself for my own stupidity, waking up in a coffin-sized box, minute after minute, day after day, so much time to do nothing but repent. And yet, if there's one thing I miss, one reason I ended up taking so many self-defense classes, I would give anything to feel that young and fearless again. It's okay, I hear myself say, and there's a gentleness to my voice that catches me off guard. What happened next?
Why,
she mutters, and I can tell she's on the verge of tears again. Do you live in Boston? I ask, trying to regain her focus. Your family, yourself, you're from around here?
Yes.
I consider my next step. Asking her name directly hasn't worked. God knows it didn't for me in the days right after my rescue. I can't explain it. It seems strange, surreal, thinking about it now. 20 years later, how can you lose your own name, that reflexive, immediate sense of self? All I can tell you is that pine coffins work an awful lot like cocoons. At a certain point, it's easier to let go, shed the layers, emerge anew, become the person he wants you to be, because to hold on to the past, the last sight of your mother's face hurts too much. So you let yourself go. Assuming one day when you get out of here, you'll find yourself again. Not understanding it doesn't work that way. A sense of self is such a fragile, powerful thing. And once you lose it... I wonder again if this girl is Stacy Summers. If we had some light, if I could just see her. But now the two of us are alone in the dark. It shouldn't matter. A victim is a victim is a victim, and there are a lot of them out there. Just look at the articles plastering the wall of my bedroom. But something about Stacy, the photograph of her smile, the way her father talked about her, so much raw pain in his voice. I wanted to find her. I wanted to be the one to bring her a happy ending. Maybe her happiness, by association, would rub off on me. I would save her, but she would help me find the light. At least that's what I thought 3 months ago. Am I crying again? I don't know. I am not okay. I reach out. I find her cuffed hands on the edge of the mattress. She flinches but doesn't recoil as I finger the marks on each of her wrists. Fresh lacerations, old scars. Could wrists accumulate so much damage in just 3 months? Or am I dealing with someone gone far longer? How long did it take me before I gave up my name? I don't know. All these years later, so much I don't know.
Why?
She whispers in the dark. It comes to me. The workaround. The kidnapper might have forced her to take a new name, but the identities of other people in her life? Tell me about your parents, I say. She whimpers. Your father. What's his name? I can hear her head tossing against the mattress, agitated. Is it Colin? I ask.
Why?
She says. Can you give me a cheer? I ask the possible former cheerleader. Give me an E. Give me an S. Give me a C. Give me an A, a P, an E. What does that spell? Escape. I might be losing it. The edge of my voice contains a hint of hysteria, but she stopped moving, is listening to me intently. Have I finally hit upon the remnant of a memory? Some inner trigger that will help snap her out of this?
Why?
She whispers in the dark. Then,
why are you doing this to me?
Because we need to get out of here. Because I'm working for Colin Summers. Because I promised him, I promised myself I'd bring you home safe. She doesn't speak. Is it just me, or do I detect a sense of wonder? I can do this, I inform her, forcing myself to sound confident. The door. I think I can jimmy it open. I can get us out of here, but I need your help. She doesn't move. You don't need to be afraid of him, I add belatedly. First time he caught me off guard, but now I'm ready.
Who?
The big guy. The one who took you from the bar, grabbed me from my apartment. I think he might be drugging me. I'm babbling now. I mean, how else can he keep getting in and out of the room without waking me? So we'll have to think of something. Maybe tear apart the mattress, jury-rig something with stuff, strips of cloth. We have resources. We just have to use them wisely. I'm getting ahead of myself. What I really need is the last sliver of wood I'm pretty sure is still stashed inside the mattress, except she's still not moving off it.
Why?
She whispers. Why what? Why am I helping you? I already told you that.
Why are you doing this?
Because we need to get out, because I promised your father. She whimpers, recoils. In the dark, I can feel her snatch her hands back. Hey, I try to reassure her. It's okay. Whatever he promised, whatever he threatened, he can't hurt your family. That's just something these guys say to control you. Trust me, it'll be okay.
I'll do what you want, please. I already told you that.
What do you mean you already told me that?
I've been good. I've been so good. I've done everything you said.
In the dark, she moves suddenly, seizes my hand.
Please? I did exactly as you said, ever since you brought me here. I've done everything you told me to. Now please let me go home. I won't tell anyone if you'll just let me go home again.
Chapter 30 10:30 Monday morning, Dee Dee finally arrived at HQ. She felt slightly breathless, mind still whirling from her conversation with the Atlanta FBI agent and the circumstances surrounding Flora Dane's rescue from Jacob Ness. Dee Dee was also acutely aware of how behind she was in her supervisor duties. Actually working the case? Check. Processing paperwork and managing leads, on the other hand? She would be good today, she promised herself as she hammered up the stairs, coffee in one hand, leather messenger bag in the other. She would sit, she would focus, she would behave like an actual supervisor of homicide, but glued to her chair, eyes on the stack of files on her desk. She would skim reports, dot I's, cross T's, and, you never know, make a groundbreaking discovery that would blow the case wide open. Who said desk jobs didn't matter? Her resolution lasted as long as it took to round the corner to her office, where she found BPD's newest detective, Carol Manley, waiting for her. The petite blonde was wearing yesterday's clothes and was nearly bouncing in place, hair standing on end. "Have you been here all night?" Dee Dee asked with a frown. Then, "Wait a second. You were going through the videotapes. Did you find footage of Flora's abduction?"
"No. I found the building inspector."
You mean the kidnapper disguised as a building inspector?
No, the actual building inspector. Turns out, he's for real.
Detective Carol Manley had definitely not slept the night before, and apparently she'd compensated with many, if not dozens, of cups of coffee. Dee Dee, who prided herself on speaking caffeine, had to ask her to slow down several times to get the story out. Carol had reviewed the footage pulled from various cameras in the vicinity of Flora's apartment, but she hadn't made any significant discoveries.
"There's too many images," she explained in a rush. "Too many locals, too many cars, too much foot traffic. Each frame, each camera, there are dozens and dozens of people, and since I don't know who I'm looking for, how do I sort that out?"
"You start by looking for Flora," Dee Dee interrupted.
"Sure, Flora, except what Flora? She was gone Friday night, Saturday morning. I think I found a traffic cam clip of Dr. Keynes's car turning down her street, but that's it.
No Flora walking the streets after that, and it's not like I have direct video of her building. Best I can do is check traffic cam footage of cars passing through the intersection near her apartment to see if she's in any of them. But again, so much traffic, so many cars, and so many windows.
Dee Dee rubbed her forehead, conceding the point. Pulling local video always seemed like an excellent idea, until, of course, you were the detective wading through it.
So I got to thinking, Carol continued in a rush. What I needed was more information, another visual clue. Then it occurred to me. The landlords. Mary and James Reichter had said the building inspector had visited on Tuesday.
Except the housing inspection division has no record of that.
Exactly. But why not start with traffic cams from Tuesday, right? Generally speaking, there's less traffic mid-morning on a Tuesday than, say, a Saturday night. Plus, we know the suspect is a big guy, which would make him easier to see on camera. I figure maybe I can get us a video shot of the actual kidnapper, or, if I'm really lucky, his vehicle and license plate.
Dee Dee couldn't help herself. She was impressed. Searching for images of the suspect from his visit to the apartment on Tuesday did make more sense as a starting point. And, yeah, a license plate.
But you didn't find him?
She asked Manly now.
Oh, I found him. Riley Hayes. Except he's not some guy pretending to be a building inspector. He's an actual subcontractor who inspects buildings.
What?
But the department hasn't seen his report yet. Hayes is still writing it up. That's why there's no record. But the traffic cam captured a vehicle passing through the intersection on Tuesday with a logo on the side. Hayes Inspections. I copied down the plate, made some calls, and voila! Inspector Riley Hayes, who did visit the Reichter's building on Tuesday.
But Dee Dee frowned, took a slug of coffee, frowned again.
I want to speak to him.
Manly beamed, bounced up and down on her toes again.
I know, which is why I have him waiting for you in room 6.
Dee Dee had to take a minute. She stashed her messenger bag beneath her desk, shrugged out of her jacket, took a few more hits of caffeine. Her mind was whirling again, and not in a good way. The building inspector couldn't be an actual inspector, because that wouldn't make any sense. A suspect checking out the building as a ruse to access keys would explain how the same person was able to enter Flora's locked, tight apartment. But a real building inspector actually doing his job? What were the odds?
Carol was waiting for her outside the meeting room. The detective was armed with a fresh cup of coffee, apparently oblivious to the twitch developing in her right eye. An experienced overcaffeinator, Dee Dee recognized the symptoms of a dark roasted high, soon to be followed by an excruciating ice pick to the temple low. Good luck with that, she thought, then opened the door to the interview room. The BPD's headquarters was a modern glass monstrosity that you either loved or hated. Either way, it wasn't the dilapidated, leaky pipe-stained, dropped-ceiling affair featured on so many cop shows. The homicide unit's offices could have passed for an insurance company's digs, with an expansive bank of windows, tasteful gray cubicles, and a blue sweep of commercial-grade carpet. Keeping with that theme, the department included several smaller rooms for private chats with families, quieter conversations between detectives. Room 6 was really just that, a small room featuring a modest table, a couple of chairs, a viewing window that could be accessed from the hall. It was neither intimidating nor welcoming, which made it perfect for conversations like this, where Dee Dee was interviewing either a possible suspect or a fellow civil servant. The inspector glanced up as Dee Dee opened the door. At first look, he was younger than Dee Dee would have thought. Close-cropped dark hair, square jaw, block shoulders. Big guy, the kind who would leave an impression on elderly landlords such as Mary and James Reichter. In his dark blue dress shirt, name embroidered in white thread on the left side, he also struck the right chord of confidence. Strong, competent professional. No wonder Mary and James had handed him the keys to their building. Dee Dee imagined many female tenants and homeowners would have gladly done the same.
"Riley Hayes?" she asked now, entering the room. He nodded, not quite meeting her eye. Nervous, she thought, on the sketchy side of honest. Then again, so were many people when summoned to HQ for official police questioning. Carol Manly followed Dee Dee into the room, closing the door behind them. The room wasn't that big. Dee Dee and Carol took a seat at the table, across from their person of interest, and there was just enough space left over to breathe. Carol set down her mug of coffee. Dee Dee saw the man's gaze flicker toward it, a reflexive inhale of wafting steam, but he didn't say a word.
"You inspected a building last week?"
Dee Dee rattled off the address while opening the file Manley had prepared on Hayes. Dee Dee skimmed the background report, noting a couple of traffic tickets, nothing of real interest. Across from her, Hayes nodded.
"That's right. How long have you been an inspector?"
6 months.
"Kind of young."
Dee Dee looked up.
"Says here you originally trained as a fireman."
"I was a fireman, till I injured my back, on the job. Doctor's orders transferred me to this."
"Like the work?"
He shrugged, gaze on the table.
"It's a job." "Hayes Inspections. You own the firm?"
"My father, George Hayes, his company."
She found that interesting.
"How many buildings do you inspect a week?"
"Depends on the week. Some buildings, such as the Reichter's place, aren't that big, don't take too long. Other properties, you can spend days."
"Why the Reichter's building?"
"Came up and the computer is overdue. City has a backlog right now, has hired firms such as my father's to clear it."
"So you were there because of the computer?"
He finally looked up, meeting her gaze for the first time.
"You can call the Housing Inspection Division. What's this about again?"
Dee Dee ignored his question.
"According to the landlords, they couldn't take you around the building. Too many stairs."
"That's right."
"Instead, they gave you keys to the various apartments."
Across from her, Hayes paused, seemed to be considering.
"Did someone say they're missing something? Is that what this is about?"
"I'm not interested in robbery," Dee Dee informed him. "Not my department."
Hayes frowned, appeared even more confused, which was right where she wanted him.
"Anyone home in any of the units?" she asked.
"Yeah, as a matter of fact."
"Who?"
"Woman, third floor. I was going to put that in my report. She wouldn't let me in."
"Do you know her name, Mr. Hayes?"
"No.
Wouldn't say she was the kind of person inclined to chat. Didn't seem to care much for city ordinances either."
"She didn't believe you were a building inspector?"
"I had to show her my ID. Twice."
First flicker of emotion on his face. Annoyance.
"Even then, she said she'd have to call in to confirm before I could enter."
He shook his head. "Some people."
"Did she let you in?"
"No.
When she called the department, no one picked up. Plus..."
He hesitated.
"What?"
Dee Dee prodded him.
"Plus what?"
"Her locks. She has multiple key-in, key-out bolts. I informed her those weren't to code. In an emergency situation, they would impede the fire department's ability to access her apartment."
Dee Dee was intrigued in spite of herself.
"And how'd she take that?"
"She informed me that fire was the least of her concerns," he said dryly. "Then she ordered me to go away. She didn't need any bureaucrats to teach her about safety."
"What did you do next?"
He shrugged.
"Asked if I could at least check her unit for fire alarms, emergency egress."
"She agree?"
"Please." "She pointed out one alarm in the hall ceiling, which could be viewed from the doorway. Informed me I should be able to see from where I was standing that it worked just fine. The green LED light indicated it had power, while the red flashing light indicated battery backup. As for her unit's emergency egress, I was welcome to check out the fire escape from the outside."
"She sounds charming," Dee Dee assured him.
"Can you describe her, please?"
Hayes startled, seemed surprised by this request.
"I don't know. Small? I mean..." He blushed. "Most girls seem tiny to me. Blonde hair, kind of messy. She was dressed casual, baggy sweats, bare feet. I don't know. She wasn't very friendly, that's what I remember most."
"And girls are generally friendly, young, good-looking guy like you."
He hesitated, his expression once again wary.
"What do you want? Did she say something about me?"
"Why, you do something wrong? Maybe lose your temper, grow frustrated? Clearly she wasn't treating you with the respect you deserve."
Hayes shook his head.
"Look, I don't know what's going on here. Yeah, I inspected the Reichter's apartment building. Yeah, I talked to some woman on the third floor, but that was it. She didn't let me in, I didn't push it. I made a note of the one working smoke alarm I could see, and then, yes, I walked around the building and checked out the fire escape."
"Climb up it?"
"Of course."
"Peer in her window?"
"What?" Hey, listen to me.
Hands up now, flat on the table, his broad face flushing.
I did my job, nothing more. I don't know what she said, but whatever it was, I walked the building, inspected the fire escape, that was it. Ask the Reichters. I returned all the keys to them. Couldn't have been more than 15-20 minutes tops. And I can show you the draft in my report, the diagrams, everything I have to do. 15-20 minutes is about right. So whatever she said happened, it didn't.
Care to take a